Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News, read by Tim Elliott. This is being recorded on May 11th, 2024. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Pass-fail: How the Colorado Legislature Changed Education During 2024 Session, by Jason Gonzalez of Chalkbeak, Colorado, and Melanie Ashmar. Aurora lawmakers advance shifting domestic violence court cases despite county warnings, by Max Levy, Sentinel, Colorado staff writer. Former bus aide facing new abuse charges, by Elizabeth Slay. Workload for food assistance, Medicare services rising, by Nina Joss. RTD's bus design contest celebrates 60 years of the Civil Rights Act in Colorado communities, by Joe Davis. Littleton parents lambast school boards, by Nina Joss. Unfortunately, we've run out of time for additional miscellaneous articles. Pass-fail: How the Colorado Legislature Changed Education During 2024 Session. Schools and money loomed large in the 2024 Colorado legislative session. State lawmakers approved a new budget funding formula 10 years in the making. They passed a fully funded K-12 budget, provided financial relief for districts enrolling in an influx of newcomer students, and gave a big budget boost to public colleges and universities. This year's session, which wrapped on Wednesday, was the sixth in a row that both houses of the legislature were controlled by Democrats. Governor Jared Polis is also a Democrat. The new school funding formula prompted the most heated discussions. Lawmakers pushed it through in the waning days of the session, with a final vote taking place on the final day. The bill, which calls for $500 million in new spending over 6 years, follows a framework created by a 17-member task force, but also includes compromises shepherded by sponsors. The bill gained momentum after lawmakers ended the so-called budget stabilization factor, which withheld constitutionally mandated funding from K-12 schools in order to fund other priorities. Colorado is now in what lawmakers have called its fully funded era, though many advocates and district leaders say that schools still need more money. College and university leaders raised similar concerns about their budgets, warning that they would need to hike tuition if the state didn't provide more funding for their operations. The powerful Joint Budget Committee, which has a heavy hand in crafting the state budget, provided millions more for higher education than Polis suggested. While the money will keep tuition increases low, concerns about chronic underfunding remain. Here's a rundown, by topic, of education bills that passed, and a few that failed, this year. Some bills have already been signed into law by Polis, while others have not. Student rights. Schools will be required to use a student's preferred name under House Bill 1039. Refusing to use a student's preferred name will be considered a form of discrimination. Bullying based on a student's weight, height, or body size will now be prohibited under House Bill 1285, which adds bullying related to physical appearance to the list of behaviors that are subject to school discipline policies and reporting requirements. Preschool, public school, and college students will be allowed to wear objects of cultural or religious significance at their graduation ceremonies under House Bill 1323. Students who are involved in the criminal justice system will have more support enrolling or re-enrolling in school and participating in school activities, such as graduation ceremonies and supporting events per House Bill 1216. The state will also begin tackling attendance, dropout, and graduation rates for such students. Student health. iMatter, a free therapy program for Colorado students started during the pandemic, will become permanent after lawmakers passed Senate Bill 1. iMatter provides 6 free telehealth or in-person counseling sessions to students in elementary through high school. Students will be allowed to carry and administer naloxone, a drug that can be used to reverse opiate overdoses, at school without risk of discipline or confiscation under House Bill 1003. By the 2027-28 school year, an external organization will provide state-funded training to mental health staff in at least 400 public schools with an emphasis on rural schools and students who lack access to mental health support, per House Bill 1406. Senate Bill 7 creates a behavioral health first aid training program that will contract with a Colorado nonprofit organization to train educators to recognize and respond to the signs of mental health crisis and substance abuse in teens. A grant program that funds school-based health centers will be expanded to include behavioral, preventive, and oral health care services under Senate Bill 34. A bill to create a task force to study how much time schools give students to eat lunch and ways to increase that time never made it out of committee and did not pass. Student and teacher safety. A task force created by House Bill 1320 will investigate incidents of student aggression against teachers, the effects of special education staffing shortages, and insufficient funding for student wraparound services. The task force will make recommendations for improvements. Middle and high school sports coaches at public and private schools will have to complete an abuse prevention training program under Senate Bill 113. Carrying a firearm, openly or concealed, will be prohibited on the grounds of any school, college, or child care center, with some exceptions, under Senate Bill 131. The Colorado Department of Education will contract with an outside organization to develop best practices for how schools respond to reports of harassment and discrimination per Senate Bill 162. Public schools must begin training their employees in the 2025-26 school year. Higher education. House Bill 1340 creates a tax credit for students enrolled in college. This bill would fund at least 2 years of in-state college for students whose families make less than $90,000 a year. Students between the ages of 17 and 26 who have experienced homelessness at any time during high school will get help paying for college under House Bill 1403. Colorado colleges and universities that enroll a higher than average proportion of students who are the first in their family to go to college will be designated as first generation serving institutions under House Bill 1082. Students who transfer from one university to another will be able to retain the credits they earned, among other rights for transfer students enshrined in Senate Bill 164. Senate Bill 51 fixes an oversight in a law passed last year that was meant to expand adult diploma programs to help the more than 300,000 residents who never graduated high school. Child care and early childhood education. A pandemic-era team that helps Spanish-speaking child care providers become licensed will continue its work after Colorado lawmakers approved ongoing funding in House Bill 1009. Colorado's child care subsidy program will get an overhaul that's meant to boost aid for some families, make the subsidies easier to access, and attract more providers to accept subsidies. House Bill 1223 will also cover full tuition for child care employees with kids in child care. Nature-based preschool programs can become licensed child care centers under Senate Bill 78. House Bill 1331 creates a $5 million grant program for academic enrichment programs that occur when the school is not in session. The programs must serve public school students. Students with disabilities. House Bill 1063 puts stricter guardrails on the use of shortened schedules for students with disabilities and will require the state to collect data on how often students miss part of the school day because they are sent home early or placed on modified schedules. A bill that would have banned seclusion, which is the practice of shutting students inside a room alone, was defeated at the request of the sponsor. State data shows that young students with disabilities are disproportionately secluded. Senate Bill 69 requires the state to create a training program for parents and special education advocates in plain and easy-to-understand language about individualized education programs, or IEPs, which detail the services schools must provide students with disabilities. Teacher workforce. School districts experiencing a teacher shortage will be able to hire more retirees to fill vacancies without impacting those retirees' pensions benefit under House Bill 1044. Rural school districts will be able to hire retired superintendents and principals without impacting their pension benefits under Senate Bill 99. Teachers will have an alternative way to get endorsed to teach special education or early childhood education, two fields with persistent shortages per House Bill 1087. Instead of completing a college program, teachers can participate in a new induction program. Out-of-state school psychologists who want to work in Colorado schools will be able to more easily transfer their licenses under an interstate compact created by House Bill 1096. House Bill 1264 creates an online portal for educators to post resumes and school districts to post job openings. The portal will also include information about career incentives, stipends, loan forgiveness programs, mentorship opportunities, and more. Teacher training. House Bill 1446 creates a free, optional training program for science teachers that will include instruction on interventions for students who are below grade level or struggling in science, children with disabilities, and students who are English language learners. Experienced teachers will get paid stipends to mentor novice teachers with fewer than 3 years of experience under an expansion of an existing program per House Bill 1376. Some student teachers will get stipends under House Bill 1290. School funding. Colorado lawmakers earmarked $24 million to be distributed to school districts that enrolled migrant students after the October 1st student count under House Bill 1389. Lawmakers passed House Bill 1390 in an attempt to shore up a new state program that provides free school lunches to all students. The program is facing a funding shortfall, and the bill delays implementing certain parts of the program in order to save money. Charter schools. Charter schools authorized by the state's Charter School Institute can now ask to share in some of the proceeds of local voter-approved tax increases when the schools need funding for construction or building renovation projects, per House Bill 1154. CSI-authorized charters will also receive so-called mill levy equalization funding, state funding equal to the voter-approved tax revenue received by district-run schools in the same communities, under House Bill 1394. A bill that would have significantly changed how Colorado charter schools operate and made it easier for local districts to close them was defeated by state lawmakers. History and research. House Bill 1444 provides two more years of funding for a History Colorado research program regarding the physical abuse and deaths that occurred at federal Indian boarding schools in Colorado. The bill prioritizes collecting oral histories from survivors. Climate education. Colorado high school graduates will now be able to earn a Seal of Climate Literacy on their diploma to show they have the skills for green jobs or a background in managing Colorado's natural resources under Senate Bill 14. Prison education. House Bill 1461 will allow incarcerated students to take full advantage of a law that grants them early release for earning college degrees. Career education. Colorado employers that employ an apprentice for at least 6 months can now get a tax credit of up to $12,600 per apprentice under House Bill 1439. House Bill 1365 allocates $3.8 million for a fourth round of Opportunity Now grants to address workforce shortages in infrastructure and building trades. Book bans. Colorado lawmakers voted down a bill that would have made it harder to remove content from a school or public library. But the issue resurfaced later in the legislative session in Senate Bill 216, with a notable omission. School libraries are not part of the bill that passed. Aurora lawmakers advanced shifting domestic violence court cases despite county warnings. A proposal to drop Aurora's domestic violence caseload on county prosecutors earned early support from conservatives Thursday, despite warnings that doing so could delay justice for victims. Aurora City Council member and Mayor Pro Tem Dustin Zivonik has said the proposal to move domestic violence cases out of municipal court and into county court is in response to a state bill that would prohibit cities that handle these cases from signing flat-fee contracts for public defender services. On May 9th, Zivonik primarily described the shift as a way to save money that would otherwise be spent prosecuting, adjudicating, and providing public defenders in those cases, while also leaving the door open for exploring the future privatization of the Aurora Public Defender Office. The legislature is trying to hamstring local government and our ability to control costs, he told members of the council's Public Safety Policy Committee. Our city has a ton of priorities that our taxpayers expect us to address. While the vast majority of cities in Colorado rely on county courts to prosecute domestic violence, Aurora started handling those cases in its municipal court in the 1890s, as city leaders grew concerned about counties not making them a priority. According to Zivonik, the city's domestic violence caseload costs it upward of $3 million each year, which he referred to as a subsidy in light of where most cities send their cases. His proposal has so far earned a chilly reception from Arapaho and Adams counties, who say they lack the resources to handle the volume of domestic violence incidents that end up in Aurora's municipal court each year, about 1,600 at the time of a 2021 report on the city's public defense system. Arapaho County spokesman Anders Nelson previously said a 2023 analysis indicated 1,588 cases could be added to the 18th Judicial District Attorney's Office caseload annually if municipal prosecutors were to cease, which is three times what it handles currently. The county estimates the cost of absorbing those cases would be $2.45 million to staff up in the courthouse and prosecutor's office. That also doesn't factor in the cost of setting up more courtroom space. Nelson said that without additional funding by 2025, the county wouldn't be able to keep up with those cases while providing other essential services. When asked whether the county expects fewer perpetrators would be prosecuted as a result, Nelson said cases would more likely stack up and take longer to move through the legal process. The timelines would get pushed back because you can only do as much as you have room for, he said. So I think it's not necessarily that they would fall through the cracks, but the timeliness would be impacted. The 17th Judicial District Attorney's Office has said it is continuing to analyze the potential impacts of their proposal, but that accepting all domestic violence cases that take place in the northern part of Aurora overlap by Adams County would drastically increase our caseload and would require immediate additional resources. Carmon Carter, the executive director of Gateway Domestic Violence Services, an Aurora agency that offers aid and shelter to victims of domestic violence, said she, too, was worried about the inability of county courts to pick up the slack of the city hall's prosecutions. I just think less cases will get heard because there's less resources at the county level, she said. I'm concerned about victims getting lost in this process. Carter said she had not been contacted about the proposal prior to the Sentinel contacting her Wednesday, at which point she reached out to Zivonik. The lawmaker said after the May 9th meeting that he is open to working with Gateway and other entities responding to domestic violence. If we do it, the way that we roll it out and phase ourselves out is going to be important, and I'm open to bringing all of the stakeholders in, he said. Nelson said talks between the city and Arapaho County are ongoing. As for whether Zivonik would support the city dropping prosecutions, even if other jurisdictions are unable to absorb Aurora's domestic violence caseload, he said he believed this was unlikely to happen, but that it would ultimately be up to counties to accommodate the city's decision. It's a question of whether or not they're going to prioritize prosecuting domestic violence cases, and they do in every other city, he said. They probably don't have the resources, but that's on the counties to figure out. A state mandate is the impetus. The bill that inspired Zivonik's proposal, House Bill 24-4, 1437, whose sponsors include Representative Mike Weissman and Senator Rhonda Fields of Aurora, passed the Colorado Senate in the final days of the 2024 legislative session. Governor Jared Polis has until early June to sign it into law. Starting July 1, 2025, cities that handle domestic violence in their municipal courts would be barred from paying attorneys to represent indigent clients on the basis of a contract that does not account for the time and effort spent on individual cases. It's not Weissman's first bill focusing on cities that choose to prosecute domestic violence. Last year, another of Weissman's bills would have ended the municipal prosecution of domestic violence completely. The bill was amended to continue to allow prosecutions while requiring that cities comply with the notification requirements of the Victim Rights Act. Zvonik was a member of a council policy committee tasked with taking positions on pending state and federal legislation at the time. He opposed the original version of the 2023 bill along with council members Angela Lawson and Danielle Jurinski, and he supported the amended version that did not end local prosecutions. The city's intergovernmental relations manager, Liz Rogers, wrote in a document presented to committee members at the time that domestic violence cases filed in a municipal court are precursors to more violent incidents that could include strangulation and death, and that limiting the prosecution of these crimes put victims in greater danger. Rogers also pointed out that keeping cases local spares victims the hardship of traveling to county courthouses in Centennial and Brighton for hearings. City spokesman Michael Brannan on Thursday said Rogers' statement compiled feedback given by the Aurora Police Department, City Attorney's Office, and Municipal Court. Zvonik said his concerns about the cost of prosecuting and defending domestic violence cases have deepened since he took positions on last year's bill. He brought up how the majority of the caseload of city public defenders consist of domestic violence cases, and said he was aware of this fact when he sponsored the RFP last year. He also expressed doubt that moving prosecutions from one venue to another would harm victims, saying district attorneys are successfully prosecuting domestic violence now and will continue to do so even if the city hands off its current caseload. "This isn't some novel idea. This is the way it works," Zvonik said. Zvonik's proposal follows several months of sparring over the future of the office. In October, Zvonik sponsored a request for proposals, or RFP, for private law firms to take over the work of public defense. Law firms were invited to submit bids for 2 months starting in January, but a March deadline came and went with no bids received. Throughout the process, Zvonik and other conservatives framed the RFP as the mechanism by which the council would decide whether to continue exploring privatization. Zvonik said on multiple occasions that the RFP would be the extent of the council and city's investment of time if no cost savings were identified, commenting in October that if the RFP failed to turn up a lower bid, the effort wouldn't move forward in any way. Supporters also dismissed the accusation by defense attorneys and progressives that council conservatives were trying to manufacture a reason to abolish the office in retaliation for former Chief Public Defender Doug Wilson's public opposition to mandatory minimum jail sentences for various crimes. Shortly after the end of the RFP, Zvonik said he viewed the outcome as the end of the council's inquiry into privatization. Despite these and other statements, in late March, Jurinski said at a meeting of the same committee that opposed the original version of Weissman's 2023 bill that the council was not going to back off from hiring private attorneys to do the work of public defenders. She also described the new bill as an attempt to stop us from trying another RFP or continuing our efforts to get rid of our in-house public defender's office in the context of the proposal brought by Zvonik. Jurinski later disputed that she had said the council was continuing to explore privatization. At the May 9th committee meeting, she framed her support for transferring prosecutions in terms of saving taxpayer money on a crime that the vast majority of Colorado cities trust counties to prosecute. "I don't really think this is up for a conversation," Jurinski said. "I support this wholeheartedly. Regardless of where the legislation goes, I don't care what happens with the legislation. I think this is exactly what should happen anyways." Also during the May 9th meeting, Zvonik presented an item that would eliminate a sunset clause for the mandatory minimum jail sentences applying to motor vehicle theft and failure to appear in court, continuing those policies indefinitely. Interim Police Chief Heather Morris cited failing rates of vehicle theft as one reason to continue the tougher sentences, though the trend in Aurora has followed statewide drops in crime. City spokesman Ryan Luby said Wednesday that the city would not have any data to release about the cost of the mandatory minimum sentencing policies prior to the committee meeting. No cost information was shared during the meeting, and Zvonik later said he did not know how much money the city has spent defending and prosecuting those cases before and since the sentencing changes took effect. However, he said he was confident that the cost was less than the personal cost to residents of having their vehicle stolen, mentioning the deterrent effect that conservatives have attributed to mandatory minimums. When asked why the city would invest in the prosecution of one municipal offense that is also handled by district attorneys while pulling back on the prosecution of another to save money, Zvonik said moving domestic violence out of the municipal court would not change the severity of penalties imposed on offenders. As for the council's current level of interest in privatizing the Aurora Public Defender Office, Zvonik said the group is not actively exploring privatization, but that another reason for the shift would be to preserve the option in light of the pending prohibition on flat fee contracts. "If it made sense for us to restart that conversation, to not be able to do it because we're already paying more than we would necessarily need to prosecute these cases in municipal court, just defies common sense," he said. Chief Public Defender Elizabeth Cotty said after the meeting that her office is not taking a position on the proposal because its direct effect will be on the prosecution rather than the defense of criminal cases. Should Weissman's latest bill be signed into law, Zvonik suggested the council assemble a working group involving the city manager and other officials involved in the municipal criminal justice system to plan how to halt domestic violence prosecutions without disrupting pending cases. Ending those prosecutions if Polis signs Weissman's bill and continuing the two mandatory minimum sentencing policies earned the unanimous support of the committee, which includes Jurinski and council members Stephanie Hancock and Steve Sundberg. The next step for the items will be a study session or regular council meeting. The proposal to shift the location of prosecutions was first announced by Jurinski in March, before she became the victim of an alleged incident of domestic violence herself during the week of April 13th. While an affidavit describing the details of the alleged incident remained sealed, the defendant, Derek Cobb, has since been charged in Arapahoe County District Court with second-degree kidnapping, third-degree assault, obstruction of a telecommunications service, and criminal mischief. Jurinski has since told Denver broadcaster 9 News that her statements during the May 6th council meeting, where she demanded the resignations of Morris Investigations Division Chief Mark Hildebrand and officers Tim Meehan, Brian O'Dell, and Seth Robertson, were the result of unspecified poor treatment by Aurora police as a victim of domestic violence. At the committee meeting, she apologized to O'Dell, saying, "Several of your colleagues have reached out to me in your defense and said that you are truly a good officer." As for the four other cops, Jerensky doubled down, saying she cannot wait to see you leave this city. The next hearing in the case is scheduled to take place May 24th. Former bus aide facing new abuse charges. A former Littleton Public Schools paraprofessional who was hired to assist nonverbal autistic students on their school bus is facing 10 additional child assault and abuse charges. The charges are added to an initial charge filed by police in April. Kiara Jones, 29, faces 9 counts of crimes against at-risk children or adult, third-degree assault, and 2 counts of child abuse, reckless bodily injury. She is accused of harming students on the bus to and from Joshua School, a private facility in Inglewood for individuals with autism spectrum disorder and developmental disabilities. An arraignment is set for Jones on July 1st. Eric Ross, public information officer for the 18th Judicial District Attorney's Office, said. Jones remains out of custody on bond. Ross added, Qusair Mohammadbai, a lawyer representing 2 of 3 families represented by Denver-based firm Rathod Mohammadbai Firm, said 10-year-old Dax Vestal and 10-year-old Andrew McBride were victims identified in the case. Each felony charge represents a separate day in which multiple instances of abuse occurred, Mohammadbai said. Vestal has been identified as the student Jones is allegedly striking in a video made public and shown by news outlets throughout the world. Around the time of Jones' arrest in April, Jessica Vestal, Dax's mother, said in a phone interview with the Inglewood Herald, as the additional charges were filed against Jones on May 3rd, that she believes the charges are a step in the right direction. I know that all of the footage has yet to be watched, Vestal said. I think we're all just hoping there is more to come. We're just hoping that everything within the law that can be applied here is. Vestal said prior to the events on the bus, Dax was an affectionate, loving, smiling, giggling boy whose mood and behaviors began to shift 6 months ago. It just kind of robbed him of his personhood, Jessica said. Blake McBride, Andrew's father, also noticed behavioral changes in his son, whom he describes as loving. To describe Andrew, he's just a quiet guy who loves to be around everyone, McBride said. He loves sharing movies with people. He loves dancing. He's Andrew. McBride feels 50-50 on the additional charges raised against Jones, as he knows Inglewood police and prosecutors are doing what they can with what they have to work with, but wants more accountability. I feel like there should be more charges only because there is so much more time that he has gone on and they don't have all the video, he said. I really feel like she is getting away with a lot more than what has been going on versus what the prosecution can actually hold her accountable for. The court appearance is one of the first in what could be a drawn-out series of proceedings. Kevin Yarbrough is the father of 11-year-old Hunter Yarbrough, who also rode bus L-76 with Dax and Andrew and Jones. He said Hunter hasn't been formally identified as a victim in the case against Jones, but police are reviewing video footage and he believes it's possible that injuries his son sustained, including a broken toe, came from his time on the bus. We have documented incidents that we think came from the bus, and it would be shocking if it didn't come from the bus, Kevin said. The additional charges come after many Littleton parents and residents expressed their frustration and concerns at 2 Littleton Board of Education meetings in April. Some parents calling for the resignation of District Superintendent Todd Lambert. Inglewood Police said the investigation into Jones began in March when the Littleton Police Department contacted the agency about an incident that occurred on the bus while it was in Inglewood. Police investigators determined that more than one nonverbal autistic student was assaulted by the suspect on a moving school bus while en route to school, An initial press release said, a page on the Rathod Mohammadbai firm site detailing the background of the case shows the families hired lawyers to represent them concerning the mistreatment their children endured. Beginning in approximately September 2023, each family saw significant shifts in their child's behavior and noticed physical injuries on their child, including unexplained scratches, bruises, a lost tooth, a broken toe, a black eye, and other deep bruises on their bodies and feet, a press release said. The parents independently communicated their concerns to the Joshua School. Littleton Public Schools was also notified of the concerns and investigation into Jones. In a letter the district sent on April 5th to the families of LPS students who ride bus L76 to the Joshua School, LPS said Jones was hired in August 2023. After satisfactory reference checks and after passing a thorough background check, she had very limited access to students during her employment with LPS, the letter continued. She has had no contact with students since March 19th, the day her employment was terminated. All the parents said they feel LPS has not addressed or taken accountability for this situation or made efforts to evoke change and prevention. The parents said they have not been formally and directly contacted by the district since April 5th. The parents said their children have been doing better since they removed them from the bus in March and that they're seeking therapy and ways to help their sons heal. Workload for food assistance, Medicaid services rising. Federal changes to aid programs and rising demand for services have pushed up the workload of the Arapahoe County Department of Human Services over the past few years. We've seen some pretty unprecedented times in terms of working with an extremely large volume of people in need, and also complexity of the Medicaid program, Human Resources Director Cheryl Turness said at a recent public hearing. She said the county's workload has increased for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, and Medicaid, both federal programs administered by the county. SNAP assists low-income families and individuals with the costs of purchasing food. Medicaid, known in the state as Health First Colorado, is free or low-cost public health insurance for low-income individuals and families. From 2019 to 2023, the department's SNAP caseload steadily increased from 19,281 cases to 32,597 cases, according to county data. Bob Prevost, the county's Human Services Deputy Director, said part of this increase in demand for food assistance could be due to economic factors. Grocery prices have gone up, inflation, and a lot of folks are hurting out there, he said. We're at the front line of that help, that social safety net. He also said awareness of the SNAP program has increased over the years due to marketing efforts from the federal level, specifically during the COVID-19 pandemic. In 2020, when the COVID-19 pandemic and the federal public health emergency began, the federal government gave families and individuals on SNAP temporary additional food assistance benefits. People who normally wouldn't have applied for SNAP before the pandemic may have signed up for benefits during this time because of the increase in benefits, Prevost said. For example, a person on Social Security who received about, and I quote here, $18 in food assistance per month before the pandemic could have seen that amount raised to $275 per month during the pandemic. In March 2023, those extra aid dollars ended, Provost said. But the awareness stuck. Even though the extra benefit amounts ended because of that marketing campaign nationally that occurred with several of our programs, a lot more folks who are out there were interested in seeing what we could do for them, he said. Medicaid program becomes more complicated. The county's Medicaid caseload is a slightly different situation. After increasing since 2019, The number of Medicaid cases seems to have fallen from 103,873 in 2022 to 85,632 in 2023. Part of this decrease could be from people who went back to work and got employee-sponsored insurance after the pandemic, no longer needing Medicaid, Prevost said. But there's also a chance the county's number of active cases is not the full picture, he said. During the pandemic, eligible Medicaid recipients were locked in to the program, meaning it was easier to get into the program and no action was necessary to maintain coverage. Now, due to federal changes after the public health emergency, these cases have a 90-day grace period to be verified and renewed. Arapaho County staff members are now in what they call an unwind period, where they have to work with families and individuals to review the locked-in cases for eligibility. Currently, there are about 10,000 cases still in the 90-day grace period, with people who may or may not choose to renew their coverage. Provost said he calls these invisible cases because they are not included in the county's current case numbers, but they could become active cases at any moment within the grace period. Once we're done with the redeterminations for the locked-in caseload and we have a little bit more time go by, then we can see what the trend will be, Turney said. Despite the Medicaid caseload not increasing between 2022 and 2023, Prevost said the workload for staff has still increased. He said federally required steps to process cases have become more complicated, meaning it takes a lot more time for county employees to process each one. One of the main changes over the past few years has been the renewal process. Prior to February 2022, Medicaid coverage auto-renewed, Provost said. Now renewal requires county and client action. Unless there was a change reported to us, the case would just automatically re-enroll in the past, he said. Now we have to touch every single case. Medicaid members must submit a renewal application every 12 months to continue receiving benefits. This goes for all cases, not just ones that were locked in during the pandemic. The renewal process now requires a phone interview and a signature provided over the phone, which adds extra time to process each case. The state and federal departments that manage these programs have also dozens of eligibility rule changes in the past few years. Once upon a time, the renewal packet was 5-6 pages long. Now it's 55 pages long, he said. Folks needing help completing that packet, bringing it into our office, just requires a lot more staff time. Prevost said the department gets 9,000 more phone calls per month than it did before the unwind period began. Efforts to maintain timeliness. Despite the increase in workload, Arapaho County meets the required time frames for processing SNAP and Medicaid applications more consistently than many neighboring counties. In February, it made required processing timelines for 89% of all kinds of SNAP and Medicaid cases on average, according to state data. This number was a fraction of a percentage point behind Larimer County and was more timely than averages in neighboring Adams, Denver, Boulder, Jefferson, and Weld counties. For the past 6 years, Arapaho County has been the leader in timeliness for processing new SNAP applications compared to neighboring counties Adams, Denver, Jefferson, Weld, and others, according to state data. For SNAP and Medicaid renewals, the county meets required timelines at a slightly lower rate than for new cases. Still, its timeliness is equal to or better than many of the other populous counties in Colorado, according to state data. Prevost said this is because renewal cases can be more complicated, highlighting the invisible caseload and the constant changes over the past couple of years. He said the county made a commitment to process new applications as timely as possible. We didn't want to chase our tail trying to always keep up with the federal changes on renewals and sacrifice the front end of the work we do, he said. Prevost said his team treats every new SNAP application like an expedited case, meaning it needs to be processed within 7 days. This helps them meet timeline standards, he said, and ensures the staff doesn't miss any emergency applications. If somebody fills out their application incorrectly, our system looks at it and says, no, this is not expedited. It's regular, he said. But when we do the interview, say we find out they put in the wrong information, it's actually an expedited case. If we didn't do it within that 7 days, then we're not timely. So we just treat them all like emergency situations. To keep up with increasing demands, the Human Resources Department requested more staff members in the county's 2024 budget. Because the state government increased its funding for the administration of these programs, the Board of Commissioners granted the division that manages SNAP and Medicaid 25 more full-time equivalent employees. Prevost said the county also has a system that helps create a more efficient workflow for processing cases. Prevost said delays in processing can often be tied to system issues with the Colorado Benefits Management System, a statewide database that determines eligibility for many assistance programs. The Medicaid division employees have sent out their last batch of renewal notices to clients and are waiting on responses from the invisible cases that are still out there, Prevost said. RTD's bus design contest celebrates 60 years of the Civil Rights Act in Colorado communities. Colorado's Regional Transportation District is celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Movement with an art contest. The agency is asking Coloradans for civil rights-themed artwork that will be wrapped onto an RTD bus. I believe that public transportation is the great societal equalizer, and the delivery of transit service is inherently linked to social justice movements and the Civil Rights Act of 1964, RTD General Manager and CEO Deborah A. Johnson said. Carl Green Jr., director of RTD's Civil Rights Division, said that the 60th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 is an important milestone for public transit. When I think about access to opportunity, whether it's jobs, employment, grocery stores, education, social services, and key public activity centers, public transportation is interwoven within the fabric of our community. And it provides access to opportunity, Green said. The idea for a public design contest comes from Green's desire to make the celebration a community effort. I've been working in civil rights and social justice-related work for decades, and when I think about what it means for public transportation and the community and the customers that we serve, I'm a fervent believer in you got to know your past to know where you're going. Green said. Green explained this thought led him to wonder about all the many options for commemorating the historic event. I thought about the 60th anniversary, in putting thoughts into the ether, so to speak, or pen to paper. How do we celebrate this landmark legislation in a way that is going to bring about awareness and hopefully bring it out action, Green said. Green said he next brought RTD partners into the brainstorming for the event. And when I think about the community partners such as Denver, NAACP, ACLU, Colorado, One Colorado, Colorado Asian Pacific United, Atlantis Community Inc., or Servicios de la Raza, Green said. He went on to name other social justice, civil rights, and community-focused agencies. Whether it's human rights or civil rights, at the end of the day, it's about leaving places better than you found it. Green said his team landed on temporarily wrapping an RTD bus with a design by an artist in the community. The bus unveiling will also include a celebration. Green said details of the event are still being determined. According to RTD, artists are encouraged to submit bus art with the following design goals in mind. Celebrate the history of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In addition to countless other federal and state laws that protect our civil, political, and legal rights, recognize the individuals, groups, or major events in Colorado and nationally that championed equity, equality, and accessibility. Create a vibrant and lively design celebrating our diverse community. Inspire action by increasing visibility and engaging the community. All design applications and artwork are due May 24th. The winning design will be announced in June and wrapped. According to RTD, the wrapped bus will be a part of the regular fixed route services in the Denver metro area through 2024. RTD outlined the following project timeline for the design contest. May 24th, artist applications and submission deadline. June 2nd, the evaluation panel starts the art design review process. June 3rd, artist and bus wrap design selected. June 14th, finalization of wrap design. Summer 2024, bus design wrap reveal. The creator of the winning design will receive $3,500. This project provides artists with a rich opportunity to bring forth ideas that illustrate these principles and constitutional rights for public reflection and enjoyment, Johnson said. For more information and to submit a design, visit rtd-denver.com/60th-anniversary. Littleton parents lambast school board's treatment of commentators bus video policy. During a dramatic meeting Thursday night, parents expressed ongoing frustrations with Littleton Public Schools as its board reviewed proposed policy changes amid allegations that several nonverbal autistic students were abused on a district school bus. Parents also condemned the board members and superintendent for limiting their time and opportunities to comment publicly as they advocated for the children. During the meeting, Board President Angela Christensen threatened to eject at least one parent. "I don't even really know why we keep coming here, to be honest," said Jess Vestal, who said her son is a victim in the case, to the board. "Every couple of weeks you find a new way to disappoint us, and I guess we come to just let you know that we will keep showing up for our kids until the correct changes are made." Among the commentators were the parents of several students who rode bus L-76, where a paraprofessional formerly employed by the school district, Kiara Jones, allegedly harmed autistic students for months. She is now facing 11 child assault and abuse charges. At the meeting, the board members discussed policy changes to extend the length of time the district keeps bus video footage from a minimum of 5 to a minimum of 10 days. The new policy would also implement randomized audits of footage from buses that transport students with complex communication or development needs. Parents, like Vestal, said the proposed changes would not be enough to safeguard children. "I can't understand how anybody with two brain cells could put that on paper and think, yes, this will suffice after what has transpired," she said. She showed photos of her son's bruises and other injuries alleged to have happened on the bus in January, February, and March. She said the policy being considered by the board would mean any videos related to these injuries could be deleted 10 days after an incident. Board President Angela Christensen cut Vestal off before Vestal was done speaking. Christensen cited the board's policy that public commentators are allowed to speak for 3 minutes, but Vestal said her husband had ceded his 3 minutes to her as she was speaking for the family. Residents at the meeting yelled and even swore at Christensen and encouraged Vestal to continue speaking. At that moment, Christensen called the meeting into a recess and left the dais. No board members followed her. Audience members continued to yell. Eventually, Christensen returned and called the next speaker to the podium. Vestal returned to her seat. At another point in the meeting, Christensen declared the public comment period over and attempted to move the board to its next agenda item. But Jessica McBride, who said her son is also a victim in the case, said she had signed up to comment and her name had not been called. Christensen said everyone who signed up had been called and continued to call for a motion for the next agenda item. As the board started to vote on the next item, McBride turned around to the residents in the room and started to deliver her public comments over the board's words. Christensen repeatedly attempted to silence McBride and then called for security to escort McBride out of the meeting. "Wow, more security than on the buses," one parent exclaimed from the audience. Christensen again called the meeting into a recess as audience members yelled, "Run away, coward," at her. "I have been here every board meeting since my kid was hurt on your bus," McBride shouted. "Can you please allow me to speak?" After a couple of minutes, Christensen, along with District Superintendent Todd Lambert, stopped resisting and McBride took the podium. "It's tough, I can imagine, for all of you to sit in this room and be publicly called out for your egregious failure," she said. "I can imagine it's embarrassing and it's frustrating for all of you to be in this position, which explains your latest policy revisions." McBride called the proposed policy revisions a terrible first draft. "It's time to sit down with the special needs community and have real conversations that will make real change," she said. In the neighboring Douglas County School District, the board changed its policies on April 23rd in response to what happened in Littleton Public Schools, with a policy similar to what the Littleton District is now proposing. Douglas School said they will implement random checks of video feeds from transportation for special education students. But the Littleton parents said they want more. They want regular, not random, audits of bus footage. They also said holding on to videos for a minimum of 10 days was not a long enough retention policy. Another public commentator criticized a recent letter to district families from Lambert, which said the district is working hard to be a state leader in student transportation safety. "What is your definition of a state leader?" she asked. "To me, a state leader is not someone doing less than the bare minimum. The revisions you are proposing tonight are insufficient." After the public comment period, before the board began discussing about the new policies, Vestal, McBride, and a group of other parents left the meeting. Marcy Phelps, the district's director of transportation, said staff time and video storage space are limitations to more consistent auditing and longer retention. She said the district is hoping to monitor bus footage for students with developmental needs weekly. Earlier in the meeting, Lambert had said the district's proposed changes are a first step. "Policy development is a multi-step process," he said. "We have spent the past several weeks evaluating everything about our work when it comes to student safety on buses. While policy work is the most important first step, this work is ongoing." Brittany Yarbrough, whose son is a victim in the child abuse case, told the Littleton Independent that she wants the district to call on experts and bring in the parents of special needs students to talk about the direction of those policy changes. The board will discuss the proposed bus policy again at its next meeting on May 23rd. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.